Dear sister, the typewritten note says, if you will give me 500 rupees to build my home, I will worship your God forever. The woman who handed me the note is pregnant and shows up outside the Mother Teresa headquarters each day in her tattered red sari along with her four children. There are dozens more like her, offering to sell their souls or exchange them for food, clothing, shelter, or rupees. Others are lying on the sidewalk, hoping to be rescued or waiting to die. Before arriving here, I imagined the Mother Teresa headquarters in Calcutta to be the one place in the world where I could find unconditional love. Now, I'm not so sure that unconditional love exists. I pay 2 rupees each morning to catch the bus to the slums, about a half mile from Premdon, the house of sick and dying. I walk by shacks with families and chickens living together, children with bloated bellies, and an elderly man who is rail thin but still smiling. I pass my newly acquainted 18-year-old friend Kerbin from Bihar, who's on the streets day after day with his dusty yellow button-down shirt, recycled khakis and flip-flops, trying to hustle up enough money to invest in a shoe-shining kit. Once at Premdon, I walk through a large concrete room lined with hundreds of army-style beds, each with a patient lying in it or sitting on it. The patients need care, but first there's work to be done. I start each day scrubbing the bedding and pajamas of each of the bedridden patients. I sit in front of a large pot of hot water and detergent, with each of my hands tightly gripping one side of the soiled bedding or clothing and scrubbing it together with all my might, before passing it on to a sister or one of the volunteers who will then dunk each item into another pot of water and wring it out. The volunteers are from Korea, Japan, England, and Canada, and sometimes the U.S. Some are here to get away from depression, monotony, or heartbreak. Some are here to find purpose and answers. That's the irony of India and perhaps traveling in general. Everyone is here not only to discover something new, but also to escape something. In my case, I'm here to experience what I imagine to be the most colorful and vibrant culture in the world, and to get away from Jay. Jay is a charming, witty guy in his good days, but on the days he becomes jealous or angry, he's a different person altogether. He spits, he flattens his hand, and jabs me in places no one wants to be jabbed. He holds me down by my throat, and then, when I'm at my worst, feeling like my soul is dead, Jay gives me a hug and tells me how special I am. I take his kind words the way a parched plant accepts water, and we start all over again. It's an intoxicating cycle, and frankly, I don't know how to get out. So I do what I do best. I travel. Before leaving for India, Jay purchased matching wooden necklaces for each of us, so we'd remember each other while separated. I'm wearing mine right now, but I don't miss him. For now I'm here, though, and I need to focus on the task at hand. I collect the items of clothing and walk up 2 flights of cement stairs that are slippery from all of the soapy water that drips off the clothes I'm carrying. On the rooftop, I feel the humid air and the hot blazing sun beat against my pale skin. I carefully pin the corners of each sheet and each nightgown before going back down the steps to get another load. My body is growing thinner and thinner each day from the trips up and down the stairs and the walks around town, and I'm not quite sure what a heat stroke would feel like, but sometimes I imagine it must feel something like this. But mind over matter, I tell myself. The most challenging part of the day is yet to come. I'm about to change my apron and go take care of the patients. Some of them have AIDS, some have malaria. And the woman who will grow to be my best friend and my reason for returning to work every day, Mari, is dying of tuberculosis. Mari looks like she's disappearing. Her skin stretches to cover her frame in a way that lets you see every detail of her bone structure. Her soft-looking gray hair is clipped so that the boils on the back of her head can get cleaned each morning. But her mind is not deteriorated. She is full of interesting facts and stories and wears an ear-to-ear smile. Every morning before I begin the laundry, I sneak into the room to check on Mari to make sure her body has sustained her for another day, and breathe a sigh of relief when I see her. Mari seems to be a living testament that the concept of mind over matter is real, and I'm certain she wills herself to stay alive. Some of the patients need help using the bathroom, moving from one spot to another, drinking water, eating, combing and braiding their hair, or picking the lice out of their hair. Others want their nails painted with pretty pastel colors, or their third eye painted on their foreheads with bright red nail polish. Mari just wants me to sit and chat with her and read her our shared Aries horoscope. The patients each have long rosaries draped around their necks as if they're necklaces. A priest comes to visit the patients a few times each week, pausing at each bedside to touch each head and offer a blessing. I cringe, thinking about spreading the lice that are living rampantly on so many heads. The patients' army-style beds are lined up end to end, with less than 12 inches separating the rows. The weaker patients tend to be located in the front right section of the room, and the patient in the first bed on the right side tends to be the one who is expected to die next. Last week, I saw a frail woman die in the front right-hand corner of the room. She was surrounded by sisters who held her hand and assured her that it was okay because she was going to see Jesus now. The sounds of those words hurt my ears, and tears began to trickle down my face as if water faucets had turned on in each eye. What if she was Hindu or didn't have a religion? What if she wasn't interested in seeing Jesus? I asked myself. What did it feel like to exit the world on those words? I felt ashamed. In that moment, I decided never to admit my Catholic upbringing to another person in Calcutta. After the woman dies, the beds are rearranged, and Mari's bed is now in the dreaded front right-hand corner of the room, next to Josephine. I can't help but worry that Mari might be the next to go. Her neighbor, Josephine, is the physical opposite of Mari. She's a sweet but crabby, heavy-set woman with a frown carved on her face. She accuses a helper of stealing her underpants when she loses them. She swears at the sisters when they tell her she can't eat any more bread because she's diabetic. Josephine makes everyone smile, even if she refuses to ever break a smile. She keeps Mari company and is Mari's friend. I'm sure that Josephine's stubbornness will keep both she and Mari going for a long time. But the other day, Josephine had a stroke and has been laying still in her bed in a near comatose position ever since. That poor girl. I feel so sorry for her, Mari says, as she talks about her 80-year-old friend. Then, Mari says she heard Josephine take her last breath, and then she was gone. It's time for me to go home, but I'm not ready to leave Mari behind, so I extend my trip twice. But my $300 budget has almost been spent, and this time I really do have to go. The life I lead here is grueling, humbling, and wonderful. I've learned to strategically dodge cars to cross the street. I don't sweat occasionally falling out of a bus. I've grown deeply attached to the patients at Primdon. By now, Jay has moved to California to start a new life there. My 80-year-old friend Mari is growing thinner and weaker. The boils on the back of her head are huge, and her tuberculosis-induced cough is worsening every day. Her smile is still radiant and contagious, and her mind is still keen. But her physical body is deteriorating before my eyes. The pregnant woman and her four children are still on Sutter Street, working hard to earn enough dal and rice to sustain themselves until tomorrow. I'm in denial about the fact that tomorrow will be my last day in India. After that, I will not awaken to the sounds of auto rickshaws, honking cars, the voices of fruit sellers, the smell of smog, the sight of bright, colorful kurtis and saris, the taste of chai straight out of the little red ceramic cups, the presence of the chaos that I've fallen so much in love with. I will not be returning to Premdon to help Mari live to see another day, or join Kerbin at a street stall for a cup of morning chai. I will get in a plane, make a quick stop in California, ironically to visit the man that I traveled across the world to escape. I will apply for one job in California to appease him. Then, when I do not get the job, I will move back to Minneapolis and work on figuring out my life. I am thin from walking marathon distances every day, but I am more alive than ever. I've rejuvenated my soul and come back to life. I've seen people die, and I've seen people live, truly live. I'm fully alive, and if I had my way, I would never leave. On my last morning, I wake up on the mattress of my empty flat, just as a woman rings the bell, hoping to clean for some cash. I don't need any cleaning, but take the woman out for breakfast at a street stall. We barely exchange any words, just smiles and wobbly head nods of satisfaction. After breakfast, I walk through the mud left by last night's rainfall. I pass the shacks, a man with dozens of chickens packed upside down into a crate, the vegetable vendor, the mango dealer, and the coconut juice guy. I weave my way across the busy road, dodging all the unorganized incoming traffic that separates me from the bus stop, and hop on the bus for my last trip to Primdon. After getting off the bus, I can't help walking slower than usual, taking mental pictures of everything. The shacks piled on top of one another, the children with bloating stomachs and ragged clothes, and the cows and the chickens in the street. When I finally arrive at Primdon, I've missed the most physically taxing part of the day, the part where we scrub everybody's soiled laundry and pajamas by hand. But instead, I arrive just in time for the most mentally taxing part of the day. I walk straight into the large concrete room with edge-to-edge beds. I stall in getting to Mari's bed. I begin at Martha's bed. Martha is another patient that likes to have me braid her hair, who has recently grown attached to me. As I braid her long gray hair, I explain that it's my last day. "Auntie, no," Martha says firmly and hits me in the arm with tears swelling up in the corner of her eyes. After I finish with Martha's hair, I keep myself extra busy. I get whatever the patients need and quickly move on to the next one. Before I know it, volunteer time is almost over, and I've yet to make it to Mari's bed. I hurry over for a final visit. Mari's bed is in the front right-hand corner of the room. It has been for some time, but somehow she keeps living. "Hi, dear," Mari says with an ear-to-ear smile. "Hi, Mari. I'm sorry I didn't get to spend much time visiting with you today," I say. "It's okay, dear. I'll see you tomorrow. We can talk more then," Mari says. But I can't deny it any longer. I will not see Mari tomorrow or ever again. It will be years before I'll have the chance to return to India, and Mari has only days left to live. "Mari, I won't get to see you tomorrow. I have to go home," I explain. "Oh, dear, can't you stay longer?" Mari asks. Her smile dissolves and her eyes become moist. "I wish," I say while holding back tears. "I have to go, but I will never forget you, Mari." As I leave, I go from having moist eyes and a sad spirit to what I call the ugly crier state. You know, the uncontrollable kind of crying when each eye becomes a salty waterfall, when you have an ugly expression on your face and you feel completely empty and sad. I'd become all too familiar with the ugly cry before coming to India. I used to sit in the bathroom of my apartment after fights with Jay, after he'd become jealous and accused me of sleeping around or of loving an ex, while holding me down and jabbing me. There was no winning, and up until India, there had been no escaping. This ugly cry is different, though. I feel sad, but not empty. I feel as though I have, for the first time in life, really grasped the concept of unconditional love. I've learned to exchange love with complete strangers. There's no time to ponder this now, though. I have just 6 hours to use up my rupees and find something special to remember this place by. I need to have a clay cup of chai again, a salty glass of orange juice from my favorite fruit stand. I need to bid Kerbin goodbye, if I can find him, deliver all my clothing to the pregnant woman and her 4 children, who are bittersweet about my leaving, sad to see me go, and excited to get some new clothes. And, oh yes, I have to pack. I down a quick cup of chai along with some biscuits and then sprint back to Park and Sutter Street to buy another bag and then search out the final gift, a perfect men's black watch for Jay. After I finish, I make a stop at my friend's Park Street apartment for final goodbyes. After one more cup of chai, I hop into the bathroom, shed my clothes, submerge a bucket into a large container of cool water, and then pour it over my head and my entire body. I slip into my red kurti, white pajama pants, give my final round of goodbyes, and I'm off. I arrive at Calcutta Airport just 30 minutes before takeoff. It doesn't sink in that I'm leaving India until I've already arrived in California. Jay picks me up at the Los Angeles International Airport, assuring me that he's a changed man. An hour later, he twists the perfect black watch into pieces, yanks the matching wooden necklaces off of each of our necks when he comes suspicious about what I had really been up to in India. My heart feels like it breaks into a million pieces along with each of the beads and the bits of the watch. And then I'm nourished with a hug and the cycle begins again. I never do make it back to Minneapolis. 2 months later, I see Mari fly above me in my dream, and I'm sure that is the day that Mari moved on. 2 years after that dream, on a cold, rainy December morning, I called in sick to work and left Jay. A decade later, my soul has come back to life.